Welcome to Sentient Developments Radio, transhumanist and techno-progressive perspectives on science, philosophy, ethics, and the future of intelligent life. My name is George Dvorsky, and you are listening to the audiocast of my blog, Sentient Developments. Topics discussed on this program include human enhancement, bioethics and emerging technologies, cosmology, metaphysics, spirituality, gender issues, animal welfare, and much, much more. So sit back, relax, and open your mind to Sentient Developments Radio. Hello, and welcome once again to Sentient Developments Radio. I'm George Dvorsky, and I'm podcasting to you today on Monday, February the 19th, 2007. All right, today's show, I'm going to focus almost exclusively on political and social issues. And for those of you who are squeamish around political and social controversy, well, then today's show may not be for you. I'm going to be talking about some pretty heavy, some pretty serious issues. I'm going to talk about the right to be wrong, and specifically see if I can draw some analogies between Holocaust deniers and global warming skeptics, and wondering what is in store for freedom of speech in regards to those particular issues, and more particularly issues of academic and scientific freedoms. I'm also going to talk about Islamic fascism. It was a term that George W. Bush bantered around last year, and I'm going to actually come to the support, strangely enough, shockingly enough, I'm going to come to the support of that assertion and see if there's any credence to that suggestion that there is, in fact, such a thing as Islamic fascism. And I will end the show with a quick little article about cyber warfare and the censuring of bloggers and the potential blogger threat. So we'll see what can be wondering if us bloggers will ever have our freedoms curtailed, particular ability to write about those things that we want to write about. So, an interesting, what looks to me to be an interesting show. I hope everyone is on board for the political issue here of Sentient Developments. Lots to talk about, so let's get started. I am satisfied, hiding in our friend's apartment, only leaving once a day to buy some groceries. So absent-minded, nighttime meeting new anxieties. So am I erasing myself? Hope I'm not erasing myself. Some of you may be familiar with a revisionist historian by the name of David Irving, and Irving was sentenced to prison early last year and was quickly forgotten about. Well, Irving was in jail serving 13 months of a three-year sentence in Austria. He is a notorious Holocaust denier and what appears to me to be anyways an anti-Semite. He violated Austria's prohibition statute, which forbids the trivialization of the Nazi Holocaust. Now, I'm certainly no fan of Irving and what looks to me to be a very warped view of history, but I find it disquieting to know that one can still be jailed in a liberal democracy like Austria for essentially being a prisoner of conscience. It appears that some countries find it necessary to ban the freedom to deny. Now, Irving may be using his credentials as an historian, whatever those credentials may be at this point, to propagate disinformation. I think he's actually willingly propagating disinformation, but he is within his rights to do so. Our society does not enforce the integrity of the memesphere through coercion. Moreover, Irving clearly subscribes to a certain belief set. There is a belief structure, even if it is repugnant and deeply ideological and hateful, it is still a belief structure. And in a free society, we really have no choice but to tolerate this sort of bullshit. That doesn't mean, of course, that we can't rail against it. Even Deborah Lipstadt, who's an outspoken critic of Irving, was opposed to his imprisonment, and she noted, "I am not happy," this is a quote, "I am not happy when censorship wins, and I don't believe in winning battles via censorship. The way of fighting Holocaust deniers is with history and with truth." And I really like that quote from Lipstadt. There's a part of me that would like to put a lot more credence into the work of how ideas work in a market environment, that the viable and the truthful ideas are the ones that will rise to the surface, and those that are lies or disinformation or just fallacies or what have you will eventually go by the wayside. As for Irving, it's all too easy to throw a hissy fit and throw people in jail when their views oppose your own. There's a kind of even a laziness to it. Rather than kind of counter him with facts, just throw him in jail and hopefully that he shuts up and everybody forgets about him. But this is exactly what's happening with Holocaust deniers. They are being thrown in jail. And disturbingly, it appears that the right to deny global warming may also be in jeopardy. And I don't think I'm making too much of this. The war against Holocaust revisionists, there are those who would like to permanently silence the global warming skeptics. The fear and dread surrounding the climate change crisis has led to a religious-like fervor and the emergence of a new political correctness. And even more bizarre is that global warming skeptics are actually being compared to Holocaust deniers. Take, for example, a recent outburst from journalist Ellen Goodman. And here's a quote. "I would like to say we're at a point where global warming is impossible to deny," she proclaims. "Let's just say that global warming deniers are now on par with Holocaust deniers, though one denies the past and the other denies the present and future," end quote. Goodman and others would like to see this sort of mimetic linkage stick, which would cause brains to automatically turn off and to see emotions raised to the boiling point. Climate change is now such a serious social issue that entire careers and reputations are at stake. Take Heidi Cullen. She's of the Weather Channel, I think, down in the U.S., and she suggested that the American Meteorological Society revoke their seal of approval for any television meteorologist who expresses skepticism that human activity is creating a climate catastrophe. Here's a quote. "Clearly, the AMS doesn't agree that global warming can be blamed on cyclical weather patterns. It's like allowing a meteorologist to go on air and say that hurricanes rotate clockwise and tsunamis are caused by the weather. It's not a political statement. It's just an incorrect statement," end quote. And just last week, a dispute erupted in Oregon, where Governor Ted Kulinowski has considered firing the state's climatologist, George Taylor. He said that human activity is not the chief cause of global climate change. And here's a quote from Alabama state climatologist John Christie, who comes to the defense of global warming skeptics. "It seems if scientists don't express the views of the political establishment, they will be threatened, and this is a discomforting thought." And again, that's from John Christie, and he's at the University of Alabama in Huntsville. "Indeed, the notion that certain lines of scientific inquiry be prohibited is unacceptable. It runs against the spirit of academic due diligence. And part of the problem here is that bona fide research is often conflated with the malevolent work of the denial industry. There's a growing network of fake citizens groups, extremists, and bogus scientific bodies who are claiming that the science of global warming is inconclusive. And these groups, to no one's surprise, are the sorry spawn of corporations who've had the most to lose in the struggle against greenhouse gas emissions. And Exxon is certainly one company that comes to mind. Again, like the Holocaust deniers, these groups are shielded by freedom of speech laws. At the same time, these disinformation engines need to be exposed, and it's our job, our responsibility as concerned citizens, writers, and activists to make that happen. Scientists and highly influential figures also need to weigh into the fray, and thankfully they have, and they're starting to more and more. Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth has been tremendously influential, and groups like the Union of Concerned Scientists are working to reveal scientific abuses and interference. Meanwhile, scientists and academics deserve to be protected from the perils of groupthink and consensus science. Jeff Quater, who is the president of the George C. Marshall Institute, he warns that rational and open discussion of climate change science that includes dissenting voices is in danger of being short-circuited at the expense of sound science and free speech. Quote, "It smacks to me of McCarthyism and Big Brotherism and is completely antithetical to the scientific process and the American political philosophy of free speech." End quote. Attacking researchers who seek to challenge the status quo, aside from it being a witch hunt, may also work to the detriment of those concerned about the environment. If there are other factors and circumstances contributing to global warming, we most certainly need to know about it. The war against climate change is at risk of becoming a new religion, where climate contrarians have been pegged as the new blasphemers. At its extreme, global warming skeptics may be at risk of being accused of crimes against humanity. And it is here where I will close by making an important distinction. It's one thing for a scientist to continue to gather evidence, pose theories, and work towards verification, but it's quite another thing altogether for unscrupulous groups like Exxon and corrupt politicians to add unwarranted noise and obstacles to the discussion. Politicians do not have the luxury of experimentation. Instead, they need to act and forge policy. Consequently, politicians are by necessity held to a different standard. They have an obligation to parse through the noise and act in the public's best interest. In order for them to do so, they must be informed by the best of what science has to offer. And in order for there to be the best science, we have to give the scientific establishment the benefit of the doubt and the freedom to conduct sound and unhindered scientific investigations. George W. Bush caused quite a row with his Islamic fascism remark back in August of 2006. The neocons were quite obviously establishing the ideological parameters within which they are continuing their propaganda campaign and maintaining the American public's high level of agitation and fear. In the process, Bush has grossly oversimplified both the nature of current geopolitics and the religion of Islam itself. Quite justifiably, a number of Muslims were quite upset with Bush's rather sweeping and inconsiderate remarks. That said, there are some underlying truths to the characterization of radical Islam as a fascistic ideology. And again, I want to make it quite clear here. I take great pains to distinguish between Islamic fundamentalism and the more commonly recognized benign and mainstream variant of Islam. The rise of fanatical theocracies in Ahmadinejad's Iran and extremist non-state actors, Al-Qaeda, have the indelible marks of far-right totalitarian politics. And I'm hardly alone on this one. Earlier in 2006, for example, a number of prominent intellectuals published a statement in condemnation of what they regarded as the rise of Islamic totalitarianism. The list of thinkers who signed this statement included Salman Rushdie, French philosopher Bernard-Henri Lévy, and exiled Bangladeshi writer Talisima Nasreen. And in the statement, they wrote that, quote, After having overcome fascism, Nazism, and Stalinism, the world now faces a new global threat, Islamism. We, writers, journalists, intellectuals, call for resistance to religious totalitarianism and for the promotion of freedom, equal opportunity, and secular values for all. End quote. Rushdie and the other members on the list, they are correct in their assertion that radical Islam has the characteristics of a totalitarian ideology, but I believe they have understated its fascistic elements. Many people have the idea that fascism is the monopoly of white supremacist types, and this is not the case. At its core, fascism describes the rise of a self-identified group that has grossly exaggerated its historical and societal significance. This self-identity, which typically manifests as a sense of superiority or shared destiny, can encompass anything from race, nationhood, religion, and a shared cultural heritage. As historian Alan Castles noted in his book, Fascism, virtually every nation has what is referred to as a pre-fascist culture. For the early 20th century Germans, they identified with their race, the Volk, and their mythical, glorious past. At the same time, many other European nations experimented with fascism, including Italy, Spain, England, and even the United States. Today, this pre-fascist culture is weak in liberal society, but it is rearing its ugly head in some of the Islamic nations. Al-Qaeda, for example, is a paramilitary organization with the stated task of reducing the outside influence of Islamic affairs. This is very much an example of cultural xenophobia and an overstated sense of social mission. Like the fascists of 20th century Europe, who feared the specter of Bolshevik globalization, many Muslims today fear the encroachment of American and Jewish values. The result is a far-right, exclusionary, militaristic, and hypersensitive counter-reaction in the form of fascism. Which leads to the next indelible characteristic of fascism, a common enemy. The racist Nazis rallied the nation to deal with what they considered to be the Jewish problem. The Jews were an identifiable enemy who could be blamed for all the problems of the state. They also targeted the Bolsheviks, whose extreme left position polarized and radicalized the right even further. For every action, there is an equal counter-reaction. Today, the Jews have once again been targeted by a far-right group, this time in the Mideast, but now they have been joined by the Americans, whose capitalist imperialism and social liberalism has taken the place of communism. Other characteristics of fascism include a charismatic and populist leader, which Iran quite clearly has in President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. What's particularly frightening is that Ahmadinejad clearly believes his own hype. He's not so much a dictator as he is an ideologue. By hype, I mean ideology, or in this case, theological ideology. And in this sense, Islamic totalitarianism is distinguished from the more secular or socialistic forms of totalitarianism, where Marxism and fascism had ideologies informed by political, philosophical, and even pseudoscientific texts. Radical Islam is a theocratic framework that draws its authority from religious sources. It's a fine point, but it is worth mentioning. Islamic totalitarianism, while arguably far right, is an ideological horse of a different color. What it shares with more traditional notions of totalitarianism, however, is that the source of authority does not come from one individual or group of individuals, i.e. authoritarianism, but instead emanates from a monopolistic ideological framework that is enforced as the only true law of the land. Indeed, democracy, due process, and other elements of social justice as we know it in liberal democracies are absent in countries like Iran and the former Taliban Afghanistan. The goal of these theocracies is to embed religious ideology across the land and to maintain a monopoly on all ideas and institutions. Radical Islam, like any totalitarian ideology, is enforced as the alpha and omega of personal existence. The state regulates nearly every aspect of public and private behavior. In this sense, the revolution that is Islamic totalitarianism is comparable to the Stalinization of the Soviet Union and the work of the Nazis in 1930s Germany. The Soviets tried to create a workers' utopia and the new man, while the Nazis worked to ensure racial purity and create a 1,000-year Reich. Islamic fundamentalists want to create a heaven on earth, a phenomenon comparable to the quasi-totalitarian and theocratic efforts of the Calvinists in 16th-century Geneva. As for the Islamic Revolution, one example that will forever stand out in my mind is when the Taliban destroyed Afghanistan's Buddhist statues. This was an explicitly revolutionary act against those ideas and institutions that potentially rivaled the tenets of the ruling ideology. All revolutions seek to destroy the past, and this one is no different. Another example of zero tolerance toward opposing viewpoints was the recent row over the caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad in the Danish daily newspaper Jyllands-Posten. Western notions of free expression and the free press are lost on the theologues. So while Bush and the neocons wage their obverse Christian crusade against the Islamic fascists, they have, likely unintentionally, revealed a disturbing aspect of extremist politics in the Middle East. And as each side continues to antagonize each other, modern politics migrates further and further into the extreme fringes. I want to go back now to the manifesto, the one that Salman Rushdie and others had signed, and I'm just going to talk about it a bit more. And this was back in March or late April of 2006. And again, these were a number of prominent European intellectuals, and they picked up on this theocratic impulse that's very much a part of radical Islam. They were motivated to do this, to put out this manifesto, when there was that furor over the Danish cartoons. And they issued the manifesto that calls for resistance to, quote, religious totalitarianism and for the promotion of freedom, equal opportunity, and secular values for all. The manifesto, which has got those notable contributors as Bernard-Henri Lévy, Taslima Nasrin, Caroline Fourré, and Salman Rushdie, proclaimed that after having overcome fascism, Nazism, and Stalinism, the world now faces this new totalitarian global threat, Islamism. And the statement was originally published in the French newspaper Charlie Hebdo. And if you don't mind, I'm going to read the statement because it's extremely interesting. So for the next four or five paragraphs, just know that I'm quoting the excerpts from the manifesto. So here it starts. Start quote. The recent events which occurred after the publication of drawings of Muhammad in European newspapers have revealed the necessity of the struggle for these universal values. This struggle will not be won by arms, but in the ideological field. It is not a clash of civilizations nor an antagonism of West and East that we are witnessing, but a global struggle that confronts democrats and theocrats. Like all totalitarianisms, Islamism is nurtured by fears and frustrations. The hate preachers bet on these feelings in order to form battalions destined to impose a liberal, societal, and unegalitarian world. But we clearly and firmly state nothing, not even despair, justifies the choice of obscurantism, totalitarianism, and hatred. Islamism is a reactionary ideology which kills equality, freedom, and secularism wherever it is present. Its success can only lead to a world of domination. Man's domination of woman, the Islamists' domination of all the others. To counter this, we must assure universal rights to oppressed or discriminated people. We reject cultural relativism, which consists in accepting that men and women of Muslim culture should be deprived of the right to equality, freedom, and secular values in the name of respect for cultures and traditions. We refuse to renounce our critical spirit out of fear of being accused of Islamophobia, an unfortunate concept which confuses criticism of Islam as a religion with stigmatization of its believers. We plead for the universality of freedom of expression so that a critical spirit may be exercised on all continents against all abuses and all dogmas. We appeal to democrats and free spirits of all countries that our century should be one of enlightenment, not of obscurantism. And that's the end of the statement. That's pretty serious stuff, and I was surprised that it did not go, it did not make bigger news than it did. Again, this is around the midpoint of last year. And, well, we'll see. History is still unfolding before us, and not quite sure yet where a lot of the struggle and a lot of the stress that's coming out of the Middle East right now, where it's all headed. But one thing I think is for certain, radical Islam and fundamentalism of any kind of of fundamentalism is truly a problem. Last year, the U.S. Homeland Security Department ran a mock internet attack to test its preparedness in cyberspace. They called the internet attack Cyberstorm, and it was the largest cyber war games exercise ever conducted. They did this because they wanted to gauge how the U.S. and the international community would respond to devastating attacks over the internet, not just from terrorists and enemy states, but get this, also from anti-globalization activists, underground hackers, and bloggers. That's right, bloggers. The Cyberstorm simulation was a challenge to government officials and industry executives to respond to deliberate misinformation campaigns and activist calls by bloggers. They had officials from the U.S., Canada, Australia, and Britain, along with executives from Microsoft, Cisco, and VeriSign, who simulated the attacks using isolated computers, and they worked in basement offices at the Secret Service headquarters in downtown Washington. And according to their accounts, the internet did in fact survive the attacks. It's generally felt that with the meteoric rise of the internet and with the information and communication revolutions still in full swing, the threat of networked groups and individuals to spread disinfo and to engage in wide-scale social engineering campaigns has never been greater. One could imagine a fleet of blogs calling for people to rise up over an issue like runaway global warming. Consequently, that the Homeland Security Department considers bloggers a potential threat really shouldn't come as a complete surprise. The military would likely shut down threatening and subversive blogs during times of war or civil unrest. Like, I'm talking really severe civil unrest. It's during such episodes that control of information flow becomes tactically paramount, so much so that nations often regress to de facto authoritarianism and even quasi-totalitarianism. As a result, the state has the power to claim a monopoly on the memesphere, including extreme censorship and propaganda campaigns. Freedom of speech is a peacetime luxury. At the same time, however, I have to think that the real impact bloggers could conceivably have is perhaps overstated. I don't think memes work in such a pervasive way, particularly not today in the age of diversified media and critical thinkers. If blogs could actually cause people to riot, for example, it's not because the blogs are telling them to do so, but because there's a genuine reason for doing so. But, as the Cyberstorm exercise shows, the revolution will not be televised, nor will it be posted on a blog. That's it for today's show. I hope you enjoyed it and hope you enjoyed the social and political focus that we had today. I'll try to return to the science and the futurism and the philosophy next week. Let me go over the track listing for today's episode. I started off the show with Of Montreal, and from their brand new album, Hissing Fauna, Are You the Destroyer? The track was called Groenlandic Edit. Those harmonies, could you believe that? Those were some beautifully recorded vocal tracks. And just a couple of listens of that album, again, the band Of Montreal, I'm enjoying it tremendously. The second track was Cult of Luna from their album Salvation. The track was called Waiting for You. The third track from a band called Callisto from their album True Nature Unfolds. The track was called Storm. And from Isis's classic album Oceanic, the track was called Carry. Those are the four tracks. Again, I hope you enjoyed the show. Hope you enjoyed the music. Look for my next podcast to appear in about a week's time. And until then, everyone have yourselves a wonderful week. Bye-bye.